Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Good evening and welcome once again to Madam Perry Salon. I'm your host and cruise director, Madam Perry. Well, you can call me Jennifer Perry, and I am happy to be here again tonight. We have had so many good, fun shows lately, some fascinating guests, as usual, and that's mainly because so many of you listen, and you share it, and you subscribe, and you leave reviews and download, and that helps me to continue to get great guests like I've got tonight. And like we've had, we haven't had any unpleasant guests. Everyone's a good guest. Monday night was a bit more serious show than we're used to. I had my friend... He's a two-time Emmy-winning investigative journalist, formerly with CNN and HLN. He currently works with Nancy Grace and her Crime Online on SiriusXM. Art Harris, also a suspense author, school teacher, and former weapons control expert with the Navy, Brett R. Wright, we love. And Brett brought, we were talking about gun violence in American schools. Is there a solution? And Brett brought his friend, Chelsea Sobolik, who was a survivor of the Aurora theater shooting, and just pretty much changed the way we had planned to go with the show. But I'll tell you what, she was marvelous. And so if you can still go back and listen to that show, it's great. Last night we had comedian Ricky Glore on there, and he's talking about his stand-up comedy as well as some musicals he's written, like placing the story of anyone who's listen to Fleetwood Mac for years and knows the backstories and all the dramas and soap operas of that band. And so a few years back, he, in a series of ongoing musicals he's written, he created this one called Fleetwood Macbeth. And did the, I guess they call it a mashup between Macbeth and that story. And that was hilarious. And but tonight, this is a book. In fact, some of the people that have read that this is going to be my guest that I've already been reading. This author's book. The book is called Hillbilly Hellraisers. In it, the author searches for the roots of rural defiance in the Ozarks and discovers how it changed over time. He focuses on experiences and attitudes of rural people themselves as they interacted with government from the late 19th century through the 20th century, and uncovers reasons why local disputes and uneven access to government power fostered markedly different reactions by hill people as time went by. Resistance in the earlier period sprang from upland small farmers' conflicts with capitalist elites who held local levers of federal power. But as industry in agribusiness displaced family farms after World War II, a conservative cohort of town business elites, local political officials, Midwestern immigrants rose from the region's new low-wage universe economy. But as the author argues, this modern anti-government conservatism is a little resemblance to the backcountry population of an earlier age, but much in common with movement elsewhere. And it's just like with the book last week we had food historian Linda Civitello talking about the baking powder wars and all the rough story behind the beginning of the baking powder industry and the backbiting, the spying, the bribing, the lying, even the Klan marches. So there's really nothing new under the sun. So I would like to introduce my guest tonight, J. Blake Perkins, author and historian. Hi, welcome to Madam Perry's Salon.
Hello.
Hi, glad you could be here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
I am delighted. I'm delighted, and it's getting a lot of attention, so I know we have a lot of listeners tonight. Actually, the full title of the book is, I call it Hillbilly Hellraisers, but it's Hillbilly Hellraisers, Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozarks.
Yeah.
And reading this book, reading your book, and I've got to say, I'm not at the end yet because there are so many stories and so many people in here that I end up going back and reading some things over just to make sure I've got the family straight and the story straight in this and to keep on going.
I understand.
You do? Okay, good. Because I was just like, you didn't finish my book? Well, I'm trying, but I have to keep going back. And then, okay, let me get these people straight. Because it's like it's like this would be a great movie. And, you know, as I keep telling people, some things, the more we learn about stuff going on, you know, nowadays, sure, there's a pervasive, ubiquitous media, and everybody's got a camera with a phone attached. And anything can be around the world in seconds. And these things sound new and provocative, things going on in politics and in the world. But if you go back and read history, there's not a whole lot new under the sun, is there?
No, that's right. You mentioned the names and the families and so forth, and can be at times a little cumbersome, I guess, to keep up with all that. But one of my goals in writing this was to really, instead of just speaking in generalizations, was to really try to put a face on these people, you know, really, as best as I could, kind of get in their minds and figure out who these people are. So you get into some details in the book for sure.
Yeah, and it's not cumbersome. You really do bring these things to life and the people and their stories.
Oh, well, thank you.
And, you know, it's just, it's interesting. So you don't want to lose, I don't want to lose anything on anybody anywhere. But the families and the individual stories and, I guess we're going to get into all that, but your book begins, I believe, in the late 19th century.
Right. Yeah.
And so, first of all, why did you want to research and write about this?
Well, I'm from the region, is one of the main reasons. I grew up and still live in a very rural, pretty remote area, and so come from many generations of kind of rural family, rural ancestors, and so forth. So I've always been, of course, fascinated with my roots and so forth, and wanted to understand, my communities and my neighbors and myself, I guess, better. I was interested in a lot of the stereotypes about people from my home area and the way that other people look at or have often looked at rural people. And so I've just had an interest. I can't really tell you a specific thing that has turned me on to this, but I've long had an interest.
So some of the families that you were writing about, you're telling stories, and especially when it gets into the thing about the moonshine stills and the federal agents who sounded like, you know, a lot of the history we hear about, you know, there's always the caricature of the hillbillies and the stories like that. And then again, though, when I read some of these stories about some of the federal raids on the moonshine stills, it made it sound like some of the cops or the feds were really more the caricatures. Sort of wanting to go in gangbusters against somebody still, not really the things planned out.
Yeah.
Am I reading this wrong? Or
No. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to start there. You can't really talk about hill people, it seems, thinking about stereotypes without thinking about moonshiners, right? And I mean, that's one of the big ones that has long fascinated people and obviously helped to kind of create this image that we have of rural people as just kind of being kind of naturally opposed to you know, federal power or the damn government, you know, that kind of thing. And so that's where a lot of those, I think, stereotypes were really ingrained in the American mind about rural people. And so I wanted to dig into that. I wanted to see, you know, what's really going on there. And so what I often find, these moonshiners are rather sophisticated individuals. They're entrepreneurs. They're small farmers who are rather innovative. And so I talk a lot about in the book and how these people are always searching to try to, to get ahead. I mean, they're small businessmen in many ways. So these anti-moonshine laws and the revenueers and the U.S. Marshals and so forth that are constantly trying to crack down on them are, they're getting in the way, and they're really obstructing their hope and their quest for what really their American dream, you know, in so many ways. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, when you said their American dream, there was a point where it was certainly, I mean, these are people that were very family oriented. Families worked together in the farm, and everything was done for, you know, the families really stuck together. And I think that's the part where you said that, you know, they could make a whole lot more money with moonshine to support their families than they could just selling the corn.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So again, they're trying to think ahead and trying to come up with innovative ways to continue to prosper as family farmers. And this is a difficult time for small farmers to be able to do that. But in thinking about the, who are the revenueers and the U.S. Marshals and so forth that are always giving them hell. One of the interesting things I found here was that these aren't really outsiders. These aren't people coming in from Washington, D.C. or, these are local elites who wanting to clean up the image, you know, in their town, you know, in their towns and in their local communities and so forth. They want to get rid of these illicit distillers and moonshiners who are giving the area a bad rap, right, in the press and so on. And they're wanting to modernize the economy. They want to bring an industry. They want to bring a more centralized agriculture and things like that. So, you know, this is not really that. Oftentimes the myths of the moonshiners and the feds, it's kind of a insider versus outsider kind of story, but that's not really what's going on there. Oftentimes they knew, they knew each other. They knew who they were. They knew what their backgrounds were. Many of these small farmers, these moonshiners, knew that the U.S. Marshals and the revenueers, well, those are the rich guys that live on, you know, over in the county seat town or whatever. They know that they see things differently than they do and often resent it.
Yes, exactly. You're right. There wasn't this one thing that was that I discovered that I wasn't aware of, that, yeah, it wasn't like it was some far off people. These were the people, you know, in their state, their home. And yeah, they knew them. So tell me, where did we start? Where did we begin for when somebody starts reading Hillbilly Hell Rages, and we start, as I said, in the late 19th century, where do we start with the situation? People are moving to Arkansas, to the Ozarks, trying to get some land, start to plant. Where did the community build from?
Okay, yeah. I mean, this is a period in the Ozarks. I mean, we've got a lot of people moving from other rural areas back east, from a lot of them from Appalachia, the Appalachian Mountains, and so they moved further west into the Ozarks, which is, of course, very similar to the region that they came from. And they're again, they're buying and settling down. They're using federal homesteading laws and things like that to acquire small family farms. And they're again, like I said before, they're kind of hoping to. That's kind of the American dream in those days, to live life and to prosper, and then be able to kind of pass it on to the next generation and all of that. But this is also the period, late 1800s, early 1900s, that Mark Twain called the Gilded Age. Right. So this is the era of monopolies and kind of hyper industrialization and a more you see patterns of a more centralized economy, and we're also seeing that in agriculture as well. So farmers, wealthier, more prosperous farmers, larger landowners are often beginning to kind of consolidate their control over markets and things like that. And so it's becoming more difficult for these small family farmers to really compete even at that point. And that process of kind of crowding them out is only going to continue as we move on into the 20th century and beyond. So it's a tough time. And so that's what's really beginning to get many of these small farmers to think about the federal government and what role, if any, it should be playing and so on.
I want to say right now, if you're listening live, and this is Wednesday, February 28th, you're listening live to us tonight. I'm talking to J. Blake Perkins about his book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, and you want to call in and talk to Blake or ask a question or comment, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922, and we'll be happy to take your call. And so, yeah, so let's get back then to... I think it's when we start to see, for me, what seemed to be the beginning of their distrust of government, the people there, is when somebody comes forward like, I'm not one of them, I'm one of you, and I'm here for you. And I believe that was Davis. Am I right?
Oh, Jeff okay, Davis? Yeah, politician Jeff Davis, right, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And makes them think that he's their man, he's there for him. I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
But then,
yeah, sure. Yeah, Jeff Davis is an extremely popular politician who, a very interesting character, and turns out to be one of the most despicable political characters. But it's interesting though. He really builds his political career on this populist ethic, as I refer to it in the book. It's so, I guess, let me back up just a little bit. These aren't one of the main points I'm making in the book, and that these many stories that I tell bear out, is that these rural people aren't automatically opposed to the federal government. In fact, far from it. I mean, many of them are calling for some of the most dramatic expansions of federal power ever. I mean, they're calling for increased federal regulations and even redistribution of wealth and things like that. I mean, they're calling for the federal government to take over the railroad industry. They are some of the strongest advocates for the progressive income tax. So, taxing the rich and corporations. And so anyway, they're in that sense, then they're certainly not just opposed to government per se.
Exactly.
And so Jeff Davis comes along and kind of to make that point, Davis becomes so popular because before he became governor, and he was elected in 1900 by the most lopsided margins and Arkansas political history, because the people loved him so much. But before that, he had been the state attorney general, and he made a name for himself by basically suing every insurance company doing business in Arkansas. And so he kind of became this kind of folk hero for the working man, you know, against the corporate insurance companies and so forth. And you know, they fell in love with him and because he was speaking to many of the issues that they were concerned about. And but then later on, once he comes to power, that's kind of the despicable part. He begins to clearly become more concerned about building up and maintaining his political coalition. And he starts to become he becomes one of the most rabid race baiters, you know, and really in all Southern political history. He's really, really plays the race card and things like that. But and in fact, during his time as governor and later he became U.S. Senator before he died in 1913, he did practically nothing. I mean, he didn't really do much in terms of policy or anything like that to help the rural people who, you know, who put him in power. So.
And yeah, you're right. He was quite race baiter. I mean, the speaking with, I think, alongside the president of the United States had to call him down.
Yes. Yeah. Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Because he publicly, Jeff Davis publicly supported or kind of endorsed lynching. And so even Theodore Roosevelt had to sort of scold him for that one.
I'm sure he didn't appreciate, but yeah, that's a pretty serious move when somebody has to scold you right out there in public and it's the president, President Roosevelt. But so they start off, you know, they're not as anti-government as people think. They're totally different from what the assumptions or opinion are. But
yeah, many of them are socialists. That's interesting. Rural socialist movement was actually quite big in rural Arkansas and over in Oklahoma and parts of Texas and Missouri. So yeah, that's interesting that many listeners may not be familiar with. My things change, don't they?
Yeah, seriously. And so tell me what you mean when you talk about populist ethic. And its relation to rules, what do you call smallholders or family farmers?
Yeah. So you know, in this populist ethic is this really this view that the federal government can and should play a role in, especially in the economy, and so they are calling for economic democracy. They resent the fact that so much of the economy is being centralized in the hands of a few, and I mean, there's so many similarities and patterns to our own times in terms of the U.S. economy at the time, and they're so this populist ethic essentially calls for the federal government to step in and regulate and redistribute resources to kind of level the playing field. So that smallholders, working class people have a chance, right? It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
The economy is not all gobbled up by a bunch of rich and powerful elites and corporations and so forth. So it's a rather pro-government mentality.
Yeah, that's it. It is pro. So, but then when the thing comes in about when you get into the book, the part about, you know, how you really make us rethink all the assumptions and all the things that we heard about or the caricatures about the moonshiners in the Ozarks and that they were anti-government and that it was a very don't tread on me type of culture, you know, those things that just turned into caricatures actually, but that's not exactly how it was.
Yeah, that's right. And another one that really surprised me, I had never heard of this before I began researching it and reading about it, but during World War One, many of these rural people were strongly anti-war and anti-military, even and resisted the draft. And so, I just found that fascinating. And some of the stories there, these rural people. We don't usually think of back to your point, these caricatures. We don't usually think of rural people as being anti-war folks, you know, but they were. And
that was another revelation, in your book is that the resistance to the war and just not and to the whole philosophy. I mean, the whole idea behind it. They just didn't agree with it. Some, I think, were on religious, but some were on ethical and other reasons.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are two things, and they often combine. Several of them are motivated by their religious objections, and so there again, we go another caricature of naturally conservative evangelical and fundamentalist Christians, but many of these rural churches were strongly opposed to war, and in fact leaned in kind of a pacifist direction. Many of them were pacifists, and so they saw this as going against what they believe were the teachings of Jesus Christ, and so many of them resisted for those reasons. And oftentimes the political and the religious intermixed. I mean, some of the major community political leaders were oftentimes these country preachers as well. And so, you know, they tended to in those days rail more against the greed and the profiteers and the sins of greed and materialism and things like that, rather than today. It's more about how the country's left God behind and
mm-hmm.
being subverted by liberals and things like that. So there's a major change that happens later on that I kind of talk a little bit about later toward the end of the book, but not so much in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's like some of them you might think, I mean, were rather progressive in their outlooks.
Who are the Brothers of Freedom?
Yeah, so that's one of many organizations, basically a union, a farmers union that developed in the 1880s. And again, there were several others in the region so these small farmers, as they began to face these struggles and they began to see, hey, well, my neighbors kind of got the same issues, so why don't we start getting together and talking about these things and come up with some ideas and essentially kind of a rural farmer version of what we might think of as of a labor union of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the Brothers of Freedom eventually morphed into the broader Farmers Alliance, which eventually became even a third party movement, and that it was quite successful for a while in the 1890s. But again, they're calling for increased government regulations in the economy, and they're railing against the rich and powerful and these greedy corporations that they argue have hijacked the American economy, and they're wanting, you know, look out for the little man kind of thing.
Tell us about the situation, because I can't really explain it as well as you can, of course. The situation that began with the USDA was going to had a campaign to eradicate ticks.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all that that ensued.
Yeah, ticks. Yeah, that's I get a lot of questions about ticks. Apparently, I'm the tick expert now. I don't know. This was a federal a USDA, so the United States Department of Agriculture program that started in the early 1900s, and the goal was to eliminate Texas fever, you know, a tick-borne illness that was killing some cattle, especially purebred cattle. You know, these purebred, these top grade stock breeds and so forth, that a lot of wealthier farmers were beginning to have. And so the USDA starts this program. The idea is to get rid of all these ticks, because these ticks are carrying tick fever, right? And they're hurting the cattle industry. They're hurting farmers, is the idea. What they didn't realize, or maybe didn't care about, was that smaller farmers who are going to bear heavy costs for complying with this program really aren't experiencing the same kinds of loss that the wealthier farmers are. They don't have these top breed cattle. They've just kind of got the old native, what they often called scrub breeds. So, and they've mm-hmm. over the years developed immunity to the Texas fever. And so these smaller farmers aren't really dealing with these kinds of issues. It's not a problem for them. And yet the USDA and is working through state and local governments and sheriff's departments and so forth are forcing this on all farmers. Basically, the argument is, well, this will raise all boats, right? It'll help everybody. And yet they enact flat taxes to pay for the at least the state and local portions of the federal program. And so that's going to the regressive taxes that are going to fall on the shoulders of these smaller farmers more. And also these smaller farmers are still in those days their cattle are roaming around on the open range. So unlike today where cattle are in fenced pastures, right?
Right.
In those days, the cattle and the hogs and everything else just kind of ran around where they wanted to, in the woods and on neighbors' property, wherever. And so farmers that were growing crops, corn or whatever, would fence in their kind of row crops. And so anyway, because of that, I mean, the program required these farmers to go and have their cattle dipped in this arsenic solution to get rid of the ticks.
Mm-hmm.
They built these concrete dipping vats to run them through, and then they run the next one through and so forth. They had to do that once every 2 weeks until the federal inspector said, okay, the ticks are gone and you don't have to do this anymore. And so for these small farmers, I mean, this required so much time and money and effort to try to round up their cattle and get them to the dipping vats. And so anyway, there was an immense resistance to that. They began blowing these vats up, concrete vats with dynamite. And in one case, I talk about an assassination. They assassinated one of these federal inspectors over the whole ordeal. So, kind of an interesting affair. But once again, they're not resisting the federal government.
Right.
They're resisting these local elites who are imposing this program on them, in which they don't really benefit from, and they're having to pay the cost for it. And it's really a program, as they see it, for these local elites and their interests. And so they're using federal authority to get what they want and force it on everybody else, kind of thing.
And so they're being forced to this, and they don't really even need it, but they're being forced to it, and it's taking time, and it's costing
right.
them.
Sure.
In a lot of ways. So it's another example of the class conflicts that they had, and that just
right.
builds that resentment that leads to resistance,
right.
isn't it?
Yes, and many of those who resisted this tick program the strongest were, once again, rural socialists. So, mm-hmm. again, that just illustrates they're not inherently anti-government. In fact, they're very
mm-hmm.
pro-government, but they... they resent the inequality there in these local business elites, these big, wealthier farmers, using federal authority to put this burdensome program on the shoulders of the little man, the working class man. Yeah.
Yeah. But the man's keeping them down is what it is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like no matter how hard they struggle to get ahead and work hard and build something to care for their families, and something to leave for their children. It's like the elite groups there just keep trying to, it's like they're almost trying to find ways just to keep them down.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that would definitely build resentment, I would think, and resistance. If you're listening live, I'm talking to J. Blake Perkins about his book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozark. And if you want to call in, the number is 646-716-9922. Well, let's go on to things like their attitude, the rural Ozarkers, attitude toward the New Deal, reform, the things had to do with, and I think there's the situation that built with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the lakes, hydroelectric dams.
Yeah.
Take us there, if you would.
Okay, yeah. Again, back to this theme about, this caricature, this stereotype of these rural people being naturally opposed to government, or this kind of don't tread on me kind of culture. These people were jumping for joy for the New Deal. I mean, for Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, even in some Republican districts that have been Republican strongholds since the Civil War, many of them switched parties to vote for Democrat here and vote for the liberal Franklin Delano Roosevelt and, you know, getting his New Deal supporters and this New Deal programs that promised to reform the economy, right, and mm-hmm. to help the working man and so forth. So they're really excited about it, and very supportive of all of that. And but what we see also, despite the, well, I think we're generally good intentions of many of these New Deal reformers, and despite the help that they did bring to many of these very struggling, especially during the Depression, these struggling rural farm families and working families, they often found that many of these New Deal programs, as in the past, were funneled through kind of the local establishment, local political elites, local business elites, the local chamber of commerce, you know. And so oftentimes by the time the programs landed on the ground, many of these local elites had kind of taken them and steered them the way they wanted them to go. And so we began to see many of these rural people complaining about, well, I thought this program was going to help people like us, but actually mm-hmm. it's just helping the big guy, you know, the big farmers and the cultural processing companies and things like that. And so they begin to feel the uneven effects of all of that. And one of the biggest legacies in the Ozarks of the New Deal era, they were the first one was actually built in the 1940s, but legislation passed in the late 30s was the creation of these hydroelectric dams and the lakes mm-hmm. that they created to do that. So many of the Ozarks political leaders, New Deal supporters, and so forth, took this opportunity of an expanded federal government and federal resources, the high taxes on corporations and so forth, and the revenue that enabled them to do this, also deficit spending, things like that. But they took that opportunity to basically try to do what the Tennessee Valley Authority was doing over in Appalachia, the TVA.
Right.
Well, let's do this here. Let's do this here. And the idea is to create these hydroelectric dams, these man-made lakes and so forth, and that'll bring in industry. We'll start to have investments coming in, new businesses popping up, jobs created, and all of that. And so they built them, and some new money did move in, but usually the rural people found that to be a broken promise. Small farmers didn't really benefit much at all from those. In fact, many small farmers in the immediate area where the lakes were built, you know, lost their farms because the government had to have room for the water, you know, for the lakes. So they were basically booted out, kicked out during all of that. So yeah, the promise that these dams and lakes are going to revive or basically create a new economy, many of them are saying, in which these small farmers are going to no longer be in poverty. You know, they're going to have good paying jobs and manufacturing mm-hmm. and things like that. It did bring in some manufacturing, but usually that was light manufacturing, non-union, low-wage type of work. And oftentimes these rural people were just mm-hmm. as poor, if not poorer, than they were before they came in.
That's such a shame. And you can see why, you know, what a depressing way to live. It's like every time you think you're getting somewhere, you're getting ahead, somebody's got a way that's supposed to work that never does, at least not for you. Well, we were talking about, or in the book you were talking about, I remember the War on Poverty. And I think this comes to maybe just post, you know, the situation you were just talking about, this timeline, because it's it was led by local, instigated or led by local business, political elites, what they call the New Ozarks Defiance. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. Yeah. So what we begin to see after World War II is what I call a really a new Ozarks developing. And I think that's important. If we're going to understand, fast forward to November 2016, and the massive support in the region for Donald Trump, who, I mean, I just can't imagine those old populists of the late 1800s and early 1900s being able to stomach, you know, this billionaire real estate tycoon from New York. You know, I mean, but so in other words, in trying to understand, well, how have things changed so much? I think we have to understand that the Ozarks changed dramatically. It's almost revolutionary. Just how the political economy changes in the rural Ozarks after World War II. So what's going on is we've got, again, small farmers, promises broken, high hopes, the New Deal and you know, things like that were going to help. They really didn't. They didn't really any, at least no long-term solutions there. And so these rural people ultimately have really no choice but to leave. They can't compete. The agricultural economy has become more centralized than ever before. Agribusinesses dominate farming now, and so there's really no room left for the small family farmer, right? The people who do their own labor and you know, maybe have a 50-acre farm that they, you know, really make a living on. They just can't do that anymore. They've been crowded out, and so they leave. Thousands of them. In some cases, over half of a county's population is gone within just a few years. So there's this mass outmigration of rural people leaving the region to go find work in places like Illinois, you know, St. Louis area, out west in California, up in Washington State, up in Michigan and Detroit. And so they're leaving, and within the region, they're headed to larger towns and cities like Little Rock or Springfield, Missouri, or places like that. So, and in their place, we have a kind of a new economy begin to be developed here. So there's almost a consensus between conservatives and liberals that, what we need to help solve the rural poverty question is business. Right? We need to attract business. We need to attract manufacturing and that will create jobs, they argue. So of course they have different approaches for how to do that, obviously, but they're really of the same mind. We need business to do that, and so many of these liberal programs under Kennedy, John F. Kennedy administration, and then Lyndon Johnson administration, are designed to try to do that. These kind of economic development projects that are intended to, you know, kind of pump money into local economies to try to lure in corporate investments and create jobs and all that stuff, and so a new economy is forming, but again, it's always almost always it's light industry, low wage, non-union type of work. It is kind of a tourism economy that tends to be seasonal, and so it's very, again, low wage type of jobs created in that. The real estate business is pretty big in the time because there's so many people leaving, a lot of real estate to be sold, and new people starting to come in, oftentimes from the urban and suburban Midwest. Many of them retirees. They've worked their lives, and they've got a pension and Social Security. They come to retire in a place that's relatively cheap to live. And so you've got all that going on. You've got a new Ozarks that's being created there. And I argue in the book that that's really where you start to see this conservative turn taking place, and replacing the old more pro-government populist culture that has existed before. Again, many of those people are gone, and you have this alliance sort of forming now between the local business elites. Those are doing quite well, larger landowners, the owners of these new local businesses, light manufacturing plants and places like that, things like that, insurance agents, things like that. And then these new Midwestern retirees who, many of them will just say it. I mean, they'll come out and say it. Oh, I left Chicago because I was, sick and tired of the, you know, who my new neighbors were, right? So with the So this racial animosity that they bring with them from urban areas. So I'm going to leave and go to rural areas. So anyway, got this combination, this alliance taking shape there that kind of creates this new kind of conservative political culture. And your question was about the war on poverty, you know, Lyndon Johnson administration. Mm-hmm. And another effort to try to, I think a well-intentioned effort to try to help bring rural people and urban people, but rural people in the case of the Ozarks, out of poverty. And there were some well-intentioned programs, but these local business elites and so forth resist that at every turn. They're proud to have the money if they can control it, the federal money. But the minute they realize that they may not be able to control it, maybe not the way they want to, they start crying a foul, you know, big government invading us and government overreach and things like that. And so that's really the that kind of defiance that I described in the last part of the book is more akin to, again, the conservative political culture that's so dominant in the region today.
You know, some of what you were talking about just a moment ago sounds similar to me, and I'm not a historian, but of people I know who live in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And very similar situations where this businesses come in. Most of the people that live there, I mean, people will talk about, you know, it's a wonderful place, it's a beautiful love to travel. But for people I know that live there, you know, they don't make a lot of money. It's mostly the tourism things that come through, and everybody has low wages. I was living there for a while, you know, and a friend of mine who moved from Atlanta up there said that, you know, she asked somebody once, and of course, you know, there's the moneyed elite, and there are the people coming there in droves to buy retirement homes.
Sure.
For the same reason, you know, but it's we call it the lack of cultural diversity, you know. So they want to live in a place like that. So there are places for wealthy people to come and move and buy houses. And, you know, it's like my mother asked me something about the Biltmore Hotel. You go to the Biltmore while you're there. I said, Mother, most of the people I know or work with up there can't afford it. You can work at the Biltmore, but you probably can't afford to go there.
Right,
if you live there, you know, so unless you're working there, you know, then no, you're not going to really see the Biltmore. But the same situation, one woman told me up there, she said, yeah, it's all breweries and hotels, so you got to either learn how to make beer or make beds. And another Atlanta friend that moved up there, she said she was talking to somebody once. She's a bartender, and she said, why do they keep wages so low up here? He goes, well, if people want to move here, they'll put up with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like just very obvious, you know, no apology, no feeling of guilt. Like, oh, well, they'll do it. If they want to live here.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. They'll put up with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last, my conclusion of the book, I talk about the rise of the Tea Party in the Ozarks. And what I found was rather remarkable. One of the strongest kind of local groups of the Tea Party emerged in Mountain Home, Arkansas, and Mountain Home was one of these towns that was just really revolutionized because it sits basically right between two of these giant hydroelectric dams and lakes that the New Deal created, and it's just, the irony is just amazing, you know, because it brought in all of these, you know, retirees from, you know, Chicago and other places that have come in, and other Midwestern wealthier Midwesterners who are investing in the local economy, buying up all the real estate and, you know, you said hotels and the kind of the tourism industry there, and yet so they're staunchly anti-government, and yet they're right there in the shadow of these multi-million dollar federal projects that really makes their lives possible and their business enterprises possible and so forth. It wouldn't be there, you know, if it weren't for the New Deal back in the 30s and 40s. So, yeah, the irony is pretty amazing.
Yeah, seriously. So you were, you know, as you said, you grew up in rural Arkansas. You grew up on a farm, and I know, wanted to ask you how that influences some of your insights, the way you approach the book. But I would imagine, though, some of the characters that I've read about in here, especially back around the turn of the century, the 19th or the 20th century, I imagine you've heard about a lot of these people almost like folk heroes growing up. And maybe you – I wondered if some of the stories that you heard about and read – If any of the stories changed quite a bit when she began to research.
Several of these people and incidents I first came across on in kind of local historical journals and kind of which tend to be more kind of folklore oriented often. And some of the stories were one of the Moonshiner stories there. Tend to be portrayed as good for him, good for him for standing up against the feds and all that stuff, but that's once you dig into the actual and do the actual research and what was actually going on, that completely changed the dynamics of the story. That's one thing. Other thing I talk about in the book is how memory and These stereotypes and these our assumptions about rural people, I think, have changed, and they've been kind of created. Nobody talks about draft resistance during World War One, in the Ozarks. That's something
I know.
Nobody wants to talk about that. That's something we just need to scrub clean and forget about that, nobody wants to remember that there was an active socialist movement in the rural Ozarks. These legends and myths are constructed and they often serve a purpose, right? They serve a purpose for their creators. And so, those memories of draft resistance and socialist and populist politics earlier don't really serve that purpose. So some of these stories did change quite a bit as I began to peel back the layers and actually do the research on what was going on.
I got to admit, the way you wrote so many of the stories, I felt like I was watching a movie or a TV show or something, and I'm like pulling from one side over the other. Not like it's going to make any difference. The story is what it is. It's history. But you wrote it, you made me feel like I was there, and I'm watching them hiding out in the trees and the gun and who gets their arm blown off.
I take that as a big compliment because, as historians, we sometimes struggle with that. We have to stick to our facts, stick to the sources. We don't have the license that a novelist has, but at the same time, I wanted to write this in a way that non-expert, who'd never heard of any of this stuff, could not only be informed but also entertained by some of the stories, and I hope I succeeded in doing that.
Well, yeah, you definitely did, and that's pretty good. That's what I tell people, history buff. And there's some history clubs that that I really enjoyed. I said, look, the right historians, it is nothing dull about this. There's nothing brand new about some of it, but some of it is not dull at all. Yeah, you wrote it very, you really took me there. Like it was almost cinematic. So that was.
Thank you.
Very exciting too. So, if you heard me, yes, somebody did get their arm blown off. And that's just one story, man. You really see it. It's like you see it happen because you talk about, it's hanging on, then they pull it, and it's like, oh, my God, this is a movie. This is a movie and a book, or several anyway. So if you've listened tonight, my guest has been J. Blake Perkins. He's the assistant, and tell me if I'm wrong, there's an update on this, assistant professor of history at Williams Baptist College.
That's right.
Native of the Arkansas Ozarks, and his book, Hillbilly Hellraisers, Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozarks, is published by the University of Illinois Press. You can get it from them. You can get it from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, any good bookseller. Go to your favorite bookstore. If they don't have it, ask them to order it. Isn't that right? Blake?
Yeah. By all means, yes.
Yeah, because believe me, this book, somebody had already messaged me earlier saying, have you read this book? You know, I said, yeah. He goes, this is pretty heavy stuff. I said, I know, but it's fascinating. So, yeah, definitely. Blake, I wish you much success with the book. And so what is your next book going to be? What have we got coming up soon?
Well, that's a good question. I've got several little smaller projects on the table right now. I'm actually editing a reprint of a 1941 book called Yesterday Today, Life in the Ozarks. And this was it's interesting, fascinating. The author was a social worker in the Ozarks during the Great Depression. And so she's writing about the rural poverty that she saw. And it's a very different kind of book than you would have found on the Ozarks in the 1930s or 40s. Most of those were, again, real folklore oriented. They were kind of portraying this romantic image of the backwoods Ozarker, lucky him, and that, you know, they don't have the trappings of modern America, and they can, you know, kind of live out lives of isolated existence and carefree existence and so forth. But anyway, she's kind of pushing, she is pushing back against that, and actually bringing to light the actual poverty that was very rampant. And so anyway, I've had a lot of fun with that, and it'll probably be out maybe within the next year or so.
And, oh, good. All right. I hope you'll come back.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd be glad to. Yeah.
All right. That will be great. Thank you so much. Again, J. Blake Perkins, Hillbilly Hellraisers and Federal Power and Populist Defiance in the Ozarks. This book, it does. A lot of it is history. It's not at all like whatever you thought you knew or heard or read or whatever as what has been portrayed to you. It's not necessarily the way it was. There's a lot of surprises, and I said there's a lot of things written in a very entertaining cinematic form. So I urge everybody, get this book. And J. Blake Perkins, thank you for being so generous with your time tonight and coming here to Madam Perry Salon. And I hope that you will return and have a great week. And by the way, folks, if you listen live, this weekend I'm going to be in Tucson at Wild Wild West Con. Do you know what Wild Wild West Con is, Blake?
No, I don't.
Okay. I've been invited out there to do a presentation on how to start a podcast and also how to promote books, because I'm an entertainment publicist. But Wild Wild West Con, but I can't call it How to Start a Podcast, Blake. I have to call it something like harnessing wireless telegraphy for entertainment, because Wild Wild West Con is a Western steampunk convention. Are you familiar with steampunk? This one takes place in the old Tucson studios. It was a movie theater. I mean, where movies were made.
Yeah,
but now it's a amusement park or entertainment. So that's where the Wild Wild West Con is held every year. This year's theme is robots versus dinosaur. I've never been to one, and I'm excited about it. So
I bet. Sounds nice. Yeah, interesting.
That's where I'll be. All right, folks. Thanks again, and don't forget to get J. Blake Perkins' book. And you know what I always tell you? Everybody's got the swing. Thank you, Blake.
Yeah, thank you.
Mother Goose